This event is the revival of EFF Austin, but it's also a very timely and I think interesting event. I think you'll all agree that cloud computing is kind of a hot topic now. And what we've done is we've pulled together a panel with some people who have some expertise in the area and also some thoughts about the issues with cloud computing, hence the title of our talk tonight, Threat or Menace. There was an email to the Bootstrap Austin list where a guy named Steve Harvey innocently asked whether cloud computing was a good way to go, whether like Google Apps, whatever would be a good way to go with his business. And of course, many people leapt into the fray and had many opinions. And we realized that there's a fog around this particular question, and that it would be good to have a conversation about it in public and to record it so that we can pass it around. And we asked the luminaries who are here on the panel tonight, who Michael will introduce in a second. Our moderator tonight is my friend Michael Hathaway from Pico Innovations. And he has quite a bit of expertise in the realm of networking and internetworking. Michael, do you want to go ahead and take over, kind of introduce yourself and do introductions all around and run for it? And I'm John Lepkoski, by the way. I'm the president of EFF Austin.
So I'm Michael Hathaway. I'm a Grants Thank You New Board member of EFF. My background is started in consumer electronics and very quickly moved from modems into Ethernet switching to high-end routers for military and commercial applications. So sort of been involved with this market for a while from the semiconductor level up to the system level. On our panel, we have Scott McCullough, who's a telecom attorney and privacy advocate. We have Andrew Donahoe, formerly of IBM, the Emerging Internet Strategies Group, now a independent technology strategist and consultant. We have William Hurley, who we call Whirly, BMC chief architect, BMC software chief architect, and cloud computing expert. We have Don Gerald, digital thinking, with a vast background in product management, intellectual property, contracts, and so on. And Chris Boyd, last but not least, from Midas Networks, which is a managed service company. So to get things started, I'm going to be overshadowed by our first speaker, Andrew, because he has put together a fabulous photo journal of the history of computing leading up to cloud computing. So I will do the pre-Reader's Digest sort of table of contents version, and then let him take over and begin the discussion. So the format here will be that we're going to have each speaker have some time to sort of present and state their views on the subject, and we very much want this to be an open conversation. So we will open it up to the room after everyone's had a short say. My twisted little view of the internet started really when it was just a cooperative peering of networks and servers in the early days. And cloud was probably something more that happened within four walls with a mainframe than anything that happened on the internet. The web kind of came along and began to create this opportunity to create a central application that everybody could log into and do things on and interact from. And with in my view, with the increasing cost of applications, as we started finding that what we used the internet for was a need to have, not a nice to have, we had to go off and buy software from companies like Microsoft, and prices went up, and this created some interesting opportunities for the consumer market to sort of make that not necessary. And now we have applications moving to the internet for businesses. This is an extremely compelling from a price and from a market entry standpoint for a lot of businesses. And I think we have folks on the panel here who are going to cover those issues. It also brings up some significant issues that I think often don't get covered, and we have some luminaries to discuss that. So we're hoping that this will be a friendly but contentious debate as we explore this, and hopefully we have all issues covered and explored and opinions aired. So with that said, I would like to hand this off to Andrew to
all right.
take over.
Okay. Thank you. Cloud has been with us for a long time.
Not that long.
Okay. But shortly after we started to make these.
And most of the issues that we're going to talk about
actually got laid onto the discs and the tapes of our society
in this era.
All right. The architecture of the problems of the cloud were set before the internet connected these machines together. The fact that our bank accounts got locked up in these machines and policies were put in place that we lost control of this data that was owned by the bank, etc. Those are things I'm sure we're going to talk about. But a lot of those policies were set back when we wore the white shirts and the very narrow ties and had the pocket protectors. Where databases were created with complex schema. Now this particular schema is a reverse engineered schema by a kid, a 20-year-old kid, of Facebook schema, of what he thinks the Facebook schema is. Gives you an idea of what kind of attacks we're having on the internet. Once people start thinking they know what the schema is, then they can start to actually think about what the data is and what they can attack and how they can try to pull it out there. So if you think your data is safe, you got people out there trying to figure out what's there and then start to pull it out. My daughter, when she went onto Facebook the very first time, she told me, oh, my data is going to be safe because it's only for college kids. They're never going to expand it. And I said, dear, I are a capitalist. You, young lady, are in for a rude awakening. And she was. She has not been compromised, but she, because I told her, you should keep your profile private forever. Now, I, of course, am on Facebook, and I'm not private, but no. Moving from databases, we go into time sharing. And of course, this is where the phenomenon of hacking started. As soon as you had unattended terminals, like, oh, that one, or the one over there. No, there's someone there. Okay. As soon as you had unattended terminals, you had data availability. All right. So we started to have problems. Okay. And then, of course, the internet. This is the interface message processor. This is from BBN. This is the prototypical device that connected the internet to 56 kilobits a second on digital phone lines. All right, this is the UR router. The internet. This is the UR web server. This is the sticker that wasn't torn off of Tim Berners-Lee Next Cube. So this is a picture of his Next Cube that's wherever it's stored, okay, in CERN somewhere. Okay.
So the web, remember, to most people, the web really was AOL, CompuServe, more AOL, Prodigy.
People really did think that was the internet. Most consumers, that was their view of things. in the early days.
Then we had our friends at Netscape. They've left the building just like Elvis here.
Okay.
And then we've got Google here, and they've got their ducks in a row, obviously. Our friends at Salesforce.com, they are sort of the poster child to business about moving software as a service, moving your important critical business data. I mean, there's nothing more critical to most businesses than your sales contacts and your business flow, your order flow, etc., up to the cloud. So the concept that this company, Salesforce.com, is doing very, very well moving this critical business data up into the cloud is astonishing to me, coming from my Big Blue background, of people losing fundamental control, physical control over this key business asset and trusting in contracts. I don't trust contracts myself. Okay. Notice their logo here is no software. In other words, you don't install software, it's all Linux. Now our friends over here, this is Oracle. It's sort of obvious, their whole architecture is they are the home of databases. Their people live on little disks, right? They live on disks. They designed that to be disks. And Larry Ellison very recently got up in front of everybody launching Oracle 11G and said, I don't know what this cloud stuff is. It sounds like everything they're doing everything we always used to do, okay? Except someone else is doing it for you, okay? And that's true. So now we got Google with Google Docs. Control who can see your documents. Except Google. Google can see your documents. And Google's very good about indexing everything and everything that comes in their world and knows everything, right? They are the Oracle. Published to on the web, automatic republish when changes are made. Migrate your data. Ooh. Okay. We're actually, these new whippersnappers on the web, Amazon Web Services, have even convinced IBM not even to run their own hardware. All right. Run IBM software on whatever white box hoo-ha stuff that Amazon runs. Okay. You know, to me, this is an astonishing, not just because I own IBM stock, okay? And I'm not even angry that I left the company, okay? They give me a lot of money to leave the company. I'm really not angry. Okay. This is an astonishing development, okay? Now, do you trust Amazon? A lot of people trust this company. I don't know how many people are ready to trust that company with key data, all right? And there are going to be people on this panel that are going to talk about the legal implications of trusting either of these companies with your key data. This is also one that scares me. You get your Macintosh, you sign up for MobileMe, and there's this button in there. Sync your keychain access. Now, a friend of mine makes iPhone apps. And in his keychain access is the keychain that controls access to his application store. Okay? Somehow, MobileMe on his account got compromised and his password got changed. So his whole cash flow stream for his iPhone applications, and he has like three or four of them, was exposed to someone else. Now, fortunately for him, no one took any money. They didn't really realize what they had, but he kind of got very, very scared, and his MobileMe account is now way, way, way canceled, okay? And they've had this long discussion with Apple about, you've deleted everything that was in that account now, right? And I suspect Apple has said yes, but I bet they don't really know. They've just said that we'll take liability. Fortunately, he's a small business. And of course, the semantic web, new and improved. Now with added meaning, it's going to find new things out there that we don't know. New connections are going to get made. New weaknesses are going to get discovered.
semantic web. It's an unknown data. Thank you.
Next on the agenda is William Farley.
So I'm here for the discussion part of this. Out of the hundreds of presentations I gave last year, I do all the slides on the fly, which pretty much would negate the need for Q&A at the end, so I'm not going to give any slide presentations. How many of you currently are using anything in the cloud? All right. How many of you think that's new technology? Anybody? Nobody's going to raise their hand? So part of what Andrew said, I agree with part of it, and I disagree, because that's why we're here. But all of those slides of old pictures of the internet and everything, there is no new magical technology that's been developed in the last year that makes cloud computing real. In 1997 at IBM, I was working on-demand computing, which was the third generation of what had been utility computing and had been grid computing before it. None of these services are any different than what ASPs did in the 90s. They're just better marketed, right? They're all still, there's some data center somewhere, it's got a bunch of servers in it, it's got all of your stuff on there, and all of the dangers are exactly the same, and all of the liabilities for them are exactly the same, so on and so forth. It's the same privacy concerns with, does your ISP send you your email if they get a warrant from the FBI? All right, it doesn't change anything. Now, that's not to say that there's not a promise of cloud computing, that's not to say that it couldn't be something great. It's made it a lot further than its predecessors. It's got a lot more money behind it, and it's a lot better marketed, right? And people are kind of getting used to this idea of, well, I don't necessarily have my data here or my application here. I just kind of use it, which reminds you of all those old terminals, huh, that you had pictures of. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this is like any other technology decision that you should take, right? What makes sense for your business, period? The cost-saving stuff is a bunch of crap. I'm about to publish a new blog on InfoWorld where I did an Amazon and I called three normal ISPs. And believe it or not, two of them were cheaper than Amazon. Because once you start scaling that, the barrier to entry is lower, right? I can get something set up on Amazon really quickly and pretty cheaply with an Apache web server. But once I actually start doing any traffic, once I start actually migrating any data, all those costs go up. And that's because cost in data centers are based on very few factors, the most important of which being how much bandwidth I'm using, because that stuff's expensive. That's why Comcast and everybody wants to have a separate internet they can charge you more for to deliver faster content, right? So with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it on so we can kind of get through this and get to the Q&A. How many of you brought questions? Come on, nobody brought a question to this? You just came to hear us talk?
We'll beat it out.
Right, all right. Well, you should start thinking of some now, because hopefully we'll get to the Q&A pretty fast.
How do you see cloud computing in its relation to service-oriented architecture?
Good question. Is anybody doing service-oriented architecture anymore?
It seems like, right?
It's kind of like, see, here's what we like to do in the IT industry. We like to chase our tail and go in circles. So I've been doing this for 18 years now. Every new thing, every SOA or SAS or whatever, is all some version of something that was already done. I work at BMC. How many people know what BMC does? Anybody? For those of you who don't know, we make the majority of our money off of mainframes, right? Machines that everybody thinks are dinosaurs and gone. Every one of you has data on a mainframe right now, I guarantee it. State Farm, 100% on mainframes, right? For example, most of your insurance companies, half of your telcos are using, you know, them for all the back office stuff. Those machines haven't gone anywhere. And if you look at how a mainframe's structured, all of the service-oriented architecture, software as a service, the time sharing that you're talking about, all of this stuff was already done. These are all new ways to do it. What we did is we migrated from mainframes to x86 boxes because they were cheaper. Then they started spreading through our data centers like viruses, right? Because you could just buy one. Any line manager could slap a credit card down and Dell would ship them one. They put it in the data center. So VMware comes along. What do? They say, well, we'll get rid of the server sprawl. They didn't. Through all of these transitions, ever since those heady days of the mainframe, software companies, whether it's SOA or any of these architectural type designs for any kind of ITILs, service catalogs, whatever it is, have failed to do the one thing that the guys up here should be doing, except for the attorneys and people who aren't in software, and that is eliminating complexity, period. That's the job of software. It should eliminate complexity. We took the mainframe and we made it transfer of complexity into the x86 boxes. We took the x86 boxes, got rid of the server sprawl. All we did was transfer the complexity into large VMs, which now need to be managed. And now the ratio of VMs that sprout up on these boxes compared to how many boxes is 50 to 1. For every one physical server you consolidate it, you now have 50 VMs. Because now instead of having to buy that box, you just click and poof, there's a new server with Apache on it, right? So, you know, all of those architectures, I mean, I never hold faith in any of those, because trying to standardize a way of doing business, I mean, ITIL is, you know, I'm not a big fan of it either, right? Because these are attempts to take best practice and other things and say, everything that I do in my business applies to you and how you should design software and how you should run it and how you should offer a service catalog to your users. And it's simply not true, right? Some of that's true. It's why products like Apache can be used everywhere. For the majority, it's not true. You know, your big financial shops who are using some of these techniques and some of these different ways of architecting their service offerings, I've been into every single one of their data centers, and almost every one of them has a different implementation. The problem with that is the same problem that I have with open standards. There's no such thing, right? Because when I was at IBM, and I'm sure you did it, and we'd sit down and do standards, for, you know, they'd send a team out, and CA would have a team, and BMC would have a team, and HP would throw a team in, and they're basically deciding how to fracture up that pie and take the pieces that they want, right? Global Services has a plan, IBM has some patents, so on and so forth. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that is a major, major problem. We forget the one thing that we should be doing is eliminating complexity, and the reason we should be doing it, which is people buy the shovel, but they want the hole. Whether you're buying a data center or using cloud computing, you don't care whether it's a server, you don't care if it's virtualized, you don't care if it's in the cloud or if it's a physical box that some guy's watching over 24/7. You have something else to do with that software. You want to use that for some other reason. It's not to have a VM. It's not to have a piece of the cloud.
Do you think so the problems are not getting more complex?
We're making them more complex. There's zero doubt.
So let me address we can peel this onion back a little bit further, because there is evolution over time. And over time, what we do see is that the complexity is changing character. Certain aspects of the problem are simplifying. We are throwing away some complexity of the old stuff because parts of those businesses are dying or they are just not as important.
But that's complexity dying, right?
Right.
But before we get too far into that,
I think you're next.
Or he could go next, right?
You can go next. That would be fine.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My background is in intellectual property and product management work, and each of those causes me to have a particular focal point on this question. Because of the intellectual property work, I do get involved in a lot of license agreements, contracts, and so forth. And some of you may have seen some of my postings on those subjects on some of the discussion lists around. Of particular interest is this, what I call the natural progression of the terms of use. I've heard Andrew said he's not a real big fan of contracts, and a lot of people aren't. But I dare say that in the end, when a dispute arises, and they will, that's where everybody goes, is to suddenly look at the contracts. And having worked for companies that produce their contracts, and their terms of use and so forth, I can tell you, here is the typical scenario, and I'll sort of prove it up with a couple of questions. How many people in the audience either are product managers or control a product because they're an entrepreneur or something? And by product, I mean either something that is a standard product or might be a service offering on a website. How many people are in the position to control that product, okay? Good. And how many of you like spending time with attorneys? Okay, maybe I should say how many of those people don't like spending time with attorneys. All right. So here is the typical tradition of the way the terms of use that really do govern these service relationships evolve. Somebody, you know, dreams up something, it's great, they get a lot of buzz, they get excitement, the marketing turns on, and everybody gets a sense of what they think that service is going to be. And then they go, we're going to have to post terms of use. We're going to have to get a license written or some sort of contract. Tell a lawyer to write a contract. Boom. And this guy goes back to, yeah, it's cool, it's great, it does all these things, and wonderful. So then the attorney, sitting in isolation, goes, well, you know, I really do need to ask you some questions. Sorry, I don't have time. I got to go off and see the customers. So the attorney dutifully will write an attorney-like contract that says, we can do anything and you can't do anything but quit. All right? I mean, that's pretty much it. The lawyer is there to make sure that the company that they are working for has the ultimate degree of, first of all, liability protection, but also that protection can extend to protecting their options for the future. So when they do that, you end up with, and as everybody probably in the room knows, when the Google Chrome license went out, they borrowed some text from someplace else. Nobody really thought about it. Nobody sat down and said, now what is Google Chrome really doing? So they essentially took terms that said, anything you enter into the software, Google has an unlimited right to use, display, move, chop up, and dice, and do whatever they want to with it. So you're thinking, I use Google Chrome to do my online banking. My passwords, my bank balances, all my credit card numbers, Google now has a license to it. Obviously, you can go, they didn't mean to do that, but that is what's in the license, okay? So you get into a dispute, the lawyers and judges are going to look at that license and say, sorry. Another little adage of contracts that people deal with all the time is, if you're negotiating a contract, it's not for the two people sitting on the opposite sides of the table. It's for the other people that replace them, who only have the contract referred to understand what the relationship is. And this is how a lot of changes take place. So after that founder that creates this great cloud computing opportunity goes and sits on the beach, and somebody else is there with a whole new staff of attorneys who have been to Harvard and they know exactly how to take care of a business, they're going, you know, we could change the way this operates, make some more money with some people back here because we're really selling information, or we can just change the way the whole thing works altogether. And look, the agreement says we have the right to do that. And the only recourse that our users have is to quit using it. So let's change things, make it easier on ourselves, and make some more money. Boom, now you've got a problem. So this whole scenario of the match between the actual terms and the service that you think you're buying, the lack of diligence that most users have of a web service, which they'll probably translate into using a cloud computing platform for their business, you can really get into a huge mess if you're not really careful, really provide some feedback to that cloud computing company, and really make sure that you are depending on something that is dependable in a business sense. Not the early buzz, not the G-Cool, wow, wonderful stuff, but really that you can build your business on something you can count on.
Facebook's a pretty good example of that. They changed their terms recently that they pretty much can do anything with whatever information has been entered into it. They had to step back a little bit from it, but there's giant gaps in their terms of use which don't address the group service capability and
right. Right. I got involved. I was supposed to be a consulting expert witness on a matter of a privacy policy. And again, the lawyers did a great job in writing a privacy policy that meant absolutely nothing, because they absolutely swore they would only share the information with their affiliates. And their affiliate is in anybody that they happen to meet, I think. So if you read most privacy policies and really do it with the sort of skeptical eye that I do or that Scott does, you'll realize they don't mean anything, absolutely nothing. So if you want privacy, you're going to have to fight for it.
So,
and that's still a myth. So.
I would recommend we segue to Scott since we're vilifying lawyers at the moment.
No, we're not.
I said good
things about it. They do their job.
I know, and he'll see bad things about it too, but he is a lawyer, so he has the right to do that.
Oh, so he's going to defend himself.
No, I became a lawyer because I figured I needed to know my enemy. I put together some death by PowerPoint here. I'm not going to go through this thing slide by slide. I do commend it to you. When I was thinking about the points I wanted to make, I had in mind the things that I wanted to say, and serendipitously, I came across a publication by the World Privacy Forum. It was published on the 23rd of this year. And as I read the thing and their summaries, I thought, well, this is what I want to say. So what I did was I pulled together their summaries and recommendations and put it in some overheads for you. And more important than anything else is the link to this report. I strongly commend it to you. We don't have time tonight to talk about all of the things that are in here, but this is a really, really good document that those of you who are concerned about privacy and security of your information, you should look at, because it is a showstopper for many people.
This is going to be on the EFF website?
Is it, Scott?
I've sent it to you. We can put it up if you want. If not, I've got it on a thumb drive, or I'll be happy to share the URL with you afterwards.
You send it to me?
I sent it to you 2 days ago.
Okay.
First of all, let me just define a term here. I'm going to use a shorthand reference here to privacy, but I don't just mean individual personal privacy. I'm just going to try to save some time by using the word privacy. What I really mean is some persons or entities need to maintain control over information. It may be an individual's desire for privacy about banking information, its contact list, what's in an email, a phone conversation to a lawyer, sitting in the confessional room with the priest, a visit with the doctor, or it could be a business that has what we in the trade call trade secret information, customer lists, pricing policies, secret processes, the thing that defines the essence of what your business is. Now, in the law, businesses have a right to protect this information. There is a great body of law. It's called trade secret law. And this information is generally not subject to compelled disclosure, except under certain circumstances. The law about what those certain circumstances are, however, is very similar to the law on individual privacy. And so when I say privacy, please keep in mind I'm also talking about business-sensitive information as well. There's a couple of things that you have to do in order to maintain privacy. You have to take special measures. You can't post something on a lamppost that you think is secret and want to claim is secret so that any passerby can go by and read it and still assert that it's private. You've waived privacy. You can't sit at a cafe with people all around you, with your lawyer, and confess to committing a crime, and expect that when this person right next to you at the table who is eating, mind his own business, just happens to overhear, could be compelled to not testify about that in a court of law. So we're also not only talking about privacy and trade secrets, we're also talking about legal privileges. Doctor, patient, priest, penitent, attorney, client. All of these privileges that have been recognized in law that apply to either individuals or businesses, the law recognizes that certain information can be maintained private. You cannot be compelled to disclose it except under certain circumstances. But more importantly, for purposes here, you can waive it. And guess what's one way you waive privacy, privilege, or trade secret? You disclose it to a third party.
Like Google.
That's right. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has dealt with this several times. There's a seminal case dealing with banking records, U.S. versus Miller. The Supreme Court held that if an individual disclosed, private financial information to the bank, that person did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy of that, and the bank could be compelled to disclose that information. And this principle has been applied for many years. It's been applied in the telecommunications area, it's been applied in the internet area, and it is fixing to be applied in this area. Because when you use cloud computing, you are disclosing information to a third party. The relationship with that third party is defined by your contract, your terms of service, the privacy policy that they promulgate and you sign on to. Now, it's nice to have a contract. I recommend contracts. You need to look at the terms of service. You need to look at the privacy policy. You need to make sure you understand it. You need to know what it means. But there's one thing that you also have to understand. That contract is between you and this third party. Once this third party gets this information, even if pursuant to contract, they can still be compelled to disclose by a simple warrant or subpoena. And sometimes the law doesn't even have to tell you that they're doing it. The federal government can send a subpoena to a bank. The federal government can send a subpoena to a cloud provider. And in fact, they can mandate that these people not tell you that your information is about to be disclosed. It doesn't even have to be a warrant in many instances. Warrant at least requires probable cause. A judge having to determine that there's probable cause to issue this, that it is evidence relevant to a crime. This could come from a basic civil subpoena. It could be a civil subpoena, not even from the government, but from some third party, say an ex-spouse, say some business partner that you have that you're in litigation with, say somebody that's just curious, say it's the recording artists who think that maybe you've got something stored somewhere that they think is theirs. They can compel the ISP or some cloud computing, which really is simply storage with some processing capabilities. They can compel them to disclose everything they know about you on a basic civil subpoena, and a judge doesn't even sign it. Usually it's a court reporter. And your contract doesn't save you on this. You have disclosed this information to a third party. You have waived privacy. You have waived every reasonable expectation of privacy. And if they disclose it under compulsion of law, which a subpoena or a warrant is, they're not liable. The material difference here with cloud computing, such as it is to be defined, and having this information locally, is that when you have it locally, it is under your control. It is your property. You get to control who it's disclosed to and under what terms. You can take the steps that you are required to take, in fact, under the law, to maintain privacy and security. If somebody wants that information, they got to come to you. And they have to follow legal process, and you know that they're coming for you. You start putting this information out there in the cloud, however you define that. We all understand that this information really is residing in one or more physical locations, which is another problem we'll come to in a second. It's really somewhere. Once you disclose it outside of your control, outside of a machine that's yours, you have released and lost some measure of control over this information. And if it's business-sensitive information, if it's private personal information, if it's stuff that you just don't want for whatever reason people to see, you need to really think twice about using this kind of thing. The last point I want to make with the short amount of time I have here is it's extraordinarily important not only to read the terms of service and the privacy policies, which these folks promulgate. And I tell you, I've written them, and I do exactly what the man over here says. Every privacy policy you have ever seen from anybody is an exercise in the waiver of privacy. That's all it is. If you see a privacy policy and you're asked to execute one, you're waiving privacy. You're better off without one. The last point is you have to have some idea of where this information is, because the law of where the information is will control the rights that you have and the obligations that this third party has to disclose it to others. If it's in Europe, there's a set of laws. If it's in China, there's a set of laws. If it's in the United States, there's a set of laws. If it's in Canada, there's a set of laws. And what are we going to do if it's in all those places? Remember, the point here isn't just being able to save money by having software as a service instead of buying software and running it locally. What you're really doing is you're spreading information around. And as soon as it's gone, you've lost control. So if information is important to you, you need to seriously consider where it's going to go, who's going to have it, the terms and conditions upon which it will be held, released, destroyed, and what control you have over their release in third parties. You also need to seriously consider whether you have waived your attorney-client privilege, whether you have waived trade secrets, whether you have waived any of the other traditional privileges under law. A substantial case can be made that indeed you have.
Kevin, he triggered a thought that I wanted to mention earlier. I'm sure most of the people in the room have seen this, but I just want to throw it back in relative to what he said. Bureau of Statistics and McKinsey and several other people have been saying for a long time that something like 80% of the Fortune 1000 companies have more value attributable to intangible as assets. That's intellectual capital, intellectual property, i.e. information, than they do any other kind of asset. 80% of the Fortune 1000 companies. So you can imagine that that is information that is exactly what he's talking about you're losing control of.
So that said, final word goes to Chris Boyd of Midas Networks.
Okay. I'm actually kind of glad to be going last because this is, gives me a chance to bring the discussion out of the clouds and back onto the ground. How many people in here work for small businesses, less than 75 employees? Okay. How many of those small businesses have unlimited funds to spend on computing resources? Okay, I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to you after this is over. All right. Okay. All right.
They're living off the bailout.
Oh, okay.
Bernie Madoff and Company.
All right. Just in the interest of full disclosure, so nobody comes back later on and accuses me of self-serving bias, I about 6-7 years ago started a company that offers small and medium businesses managed desktop, managed servers, and managed co-location and backup. So I have a vested interest in things not going to the cloud. However, all that said, I think that there is a lot of danger with these cloud computing initiatives and things like that. And I fully understand the pressures that a small business has, you know, trying to reduce costs on software, trying to reduce costs on new PCs and things like that. But the biggest threat that I really see with a lot of these cloud-based services is that, you know, it's like the crack dealer. Your first one's free. Yeah, and so you come in, you start your small business, you launch your small business, and you pick, you know, my favorite is the Yugle application that runs out there somewhere in the cloud and does something wonderful for your business. You know, manages your customer relationships, it manages your email, it does whatever. And so you grow, you're growing, and you hit some magic number. And that magic number may be 15 users, it may be 50 users or whatever, and then all of a sudden Google sends you a big fat bill and says, pay up or move out. And if you've built your entire business process around that cloud-based application, you're looking at a very sudden, very painful re-engineering of your entire business process. So that's my kind of cautionary tale about all these free services that are cropping up. They're only free as long as the advertising supports it. They're only free as long as you've got limited numbers of people using it. And they're only free as long as that company can afford to continue offering it. But, you know, trust me, Worley said that bandwidth is the most expensive component. I don't think so anymore. It's power and cooling to keep those computers and those servers cool. We were really, really feeling the pain when the energy prices went up because our fuel surcharges and our electric bill tripled in 1 month, and it was quite bad. So as long as somebody's going to keep paying for bandwidth, power, and cooling, that free service isn't really free, and sooner or later somebody's going to come back and want to get paid for that. And as these companies get bigger and go public, then that pressure to extract dollars from all these, you know, leeching, freeloading users becomes more and more apparent. So that's kind of my cautionary tale and my warning about cloud computing. If you're going to build a business process around it, think about it, look at your terms of service, look at how much it's going to cost, and think, okay, if this thing goes up in price 10x or 100x next month because they need, suddenly that VP that runs that division has to show profitability, can you survive it? So that's my bit.
And a point of clarification, bandwidth charges being like Amazon to the customer.
Oh, okay.
Not from the data center side.
Okay, yeah.
So I was going to throw an observation out just to cause some discussion. It sounds to me, and I've had this feeling all along. There's an inherent issue with simply having data outside of your control. That's beyond cloud computing, way beyond, and I think Worley made the point that this is nothing new. This is, when you surrender information to your insurance company, that's on a server, that's out of your control. So it seems to me, I'll just throw this out, is not the problem that we have just really crappy policies in place that need to be changed, and that's fundamentally the problem. Is that not the problem, not cloud computing? Cloud computing just exacerbates it and brings this shared or this moving data outside of your realm of control. It's just another aspect of that, but aren't we really talking about a different problem?
Well, actually, I think that's an excellent point because for the last 2 years, I've actually not been focusing on cloud computing. I've been focusing on the relationship between network access providers, DSL, cable, wireless, and broadband customers. Now, some of y'all may know that many of these providers are beginning to do things like managing their network, and one of the ways in which they do it is by engaging in deep packet inspection in order to determine what kind of application is being run or what kind of information is being sent across the network so that the network can then be managed supposedly to make it work best for everyone. Well, guess what happens when you do deep packet inspection and you're a network operator? You're looking at the content of communications. And so now the question becomes, okay, if I'm a user of a broadband provider and the broadband provider is looking at the content of my communications, do I have an expectation of privacy? So the same issues arise. And truly, it is in fact correct. What we're really talking about here is how you as an individual or a business can maintain control over really, really important, valuable stuff, whether it's monetarily valuable or just personally valuable. And we're talking about information. This is the information age, right? It has come up in the context of cloud computing. But I think we're going to see the same issues really start to be litigated soon in some other areas as well.
So what are some examples? I just don't want to be too much on like being really worried about the data without having some specifics. Like, what are some pitfalls that people are
using? Encryption.
Well, yeah, okay, sure. All that stuff has like kind of a cost. So what are we so worried about like data wise? Like what?
Well, why should not be right? That's why I say it's what's best for your business. I mean, how many people show up? Any privacy on the internet? Anyone think they have privacy? None of you. One guy, right?
I mean, with SSL, 128 or more encryption, you do have a lot of privacy.
Unfortunately, incorrect. Here's the way that encryption works. Encryption is a mechanism for making it take longer for guys like me to get through the data. It takes two things, time and compute resources, and that's it, right? For example, in 2002, I broke all of the Mandalay Bay Resort's physical and digital security all the way into the back rooms of the AS400s in under 4 hours, and they had better encryption than that.
That was
guaranteed.
Huh?
Yeah, it was AS400. Yeah, but they did all that, and then they stored everything on an AS400. It was like, something is going to happen.
Security doesn't mean that something can't be hacked. It just means the degree or the severity to which it's protected.
He's right. From a technical perspective, yes, it can be hacked. But from a legal perspective, If you engage in something like encryption, and you're doing it point-to-point between two of your own sites, say some tunnel between two of your machines, you have taken the steps that are required in order to maintain the expectation of privacy. I mean, if I have a private conversation with my lawyer in my lawyer's office, and somebody's got one of those little special microphones that can point a signal and listen through the walls, I've not waived privacy, even though the information is disclosed.
Right.
So from a legal perspective, encryption probably works to preserve.
Well, from a legal perspective, and not being a lawyer, but I've unfortunately found myself in the middle of a lot of these cases somehow, you know, it's all about due care, right? If you sue me and I'm the person that's supposed to be protecting your privacy, what the judge wants to know is, did I do within reason what I could do to protect it? In those cases, he's exactly right. If I said, hey, I used the best encryption available and I did background checks on the people who had access and I did all of this stuff, I can prove a good case of due care. And you lost your stuff, your privacy was invaded, but I did everything I could do, right?
If the previous question was about, you know, is all of this dire consequence of losing all my data or having it hacked or the service disappearing altogether, if that's like too much of a, you know, a low probability for you, let me throw a slightly different perspective at you. A lot of people have a product orientation, even if they're just knowledge workers, because they produce reports and documents and data and so forth in some sort of a tangible form that is their product. You know what I mean by knowledge worker, right? And if you're using cloud computing to produce that information and you want it to be structured in a certain way and look a certain way, then the value of your product is tied to the way in which that cloud environment operates. They don't have to change a whole lot for one of your databases, or maybe it's a movie, some digital content that you're producing, to suddenly go funky, okay? And if you think about it, that little bit of loss of value, if you're really depending, you know, on the cloud computing environment for operating your business, could be enough to really give you second thoughts, or should be.
Yeah, the only thing I can see with that is, like, you guys are sort of saying the option is either, you know, look at these people, like, providing this great service for you, or do it yourself. And I mean, I think a lot of people are saying, I can't do it myself, or, like, obviously, our company can't afford to do it ourselves. That's why you go for a provider. So,
and I think what's being said isn't necessarily, like, you're right. Businesses have time or money with which they can do everything, right? It's like, I do a lot of open source, right? Now you think, like, who uses open source, right? The guys who have more time than money almost every time, all right? So it's the same thing with this. It's not that, and if you want to read a good interview, I just did an interview on InfoWorld this week with Brad Templeton. From the EFF on, is cloud computing evil? And he talked about the Fourth Amendment implications and all of this stuff. And even Brad will tell you, it's not that, like, oh, it's evil. Yeah, we're throwing out some warnings, we're throwing out some opinions,
just
right?
Mostly evil.
The situation is, what can you do, you know, with the resources you have? And cloud computing, as you call it, may be a great option, right? I mean, in my experience so far, most of the offerings end up costing more than it would be to hire someone to do it for you. For example, Salesforce.com has a thing called IdeaStorm, right? Dell uses it, if anybody's seen that site, and Starbucks uses it. Well, I went to price that out, okay? I'm working on a project and I wanted to use that. First of all, it took them 6 weeks was their estimate of how long it would take to turn it on. It doesn't sound like cloud computing to me, right? Not at least what I've read about it. And the total cost for the numbers of users I would have was over $2 million in the estimate. All right, so do you want to know, man, I could build an entire data center for $2 million. You know? I mean, so it's not a matter of, like, you're right, as a small business, you may have it. I think that if you look at it from a technical perspective, we're saying, well, just be careful that you can get out of what you get into, right? Data portability should be your number one concern from our perspective. From a legal perspective, I think they're saying, be careful, because if you have a server where you're taking a service where you're taking information from customers, and you're using that cloud computing infrastructure, then there's all kind of implications to your business, right? It puts you on the hook, so you got to be careful there as well.
So I would say that we can, in answer to your question, from a legal perspective, it's an and. It's a threat and a menace.
Everything's a threat in the minutes from a legal perspective. Yes.
Well, but in this,
it's kind of like, how much trouble am I going to get? Because there's a good chance you're going to do something wrong.
Here's the deal: when you get sued, you'll know. Before then,
And from a technical perspective, it really is about business risk. Yeah. Okay, and like I said about Salesforce.com, to me it's astonishing that any company with any sales of any scope is willing to put those data records in the hands of a third party. That is the lifeblood of their business. It astonishes me.
It is kind of mind-blowing.
So there's another angle here that we haven't talked about, because we've talked about data portability, data security, and privacy, but there's now cloud computing apps that allow me to develop my own apps, like Kick Apps, for instance.
Google
so
apps,
I could so. Go and develop an entire website, an entire web application that relies on cloud computing applications.
Well, that
and go build a customer base, and that goes beyond data. Now I'm running applications.
That one's easy, though. That just means you're stupid.
I'm simply pointing out that that is the next trend.
No, you're absolutely right.
And so it's now going beyond data. There are literally applications that are being run that you can build and integrate into your apps.
And before Google Apps launched, I got one of those like, hey, come preview this. And the first thing I thought was like, who the hell is ever going to write all of their code on an infrastructure they don't own that, by the way, only runs in Python and only runs on Google servers. Right.
And if you want to get your data, you pay $1,500
to get it back.
We got a question.
Yes, back to
you. Yeah, I'm going to jump in here. I'm a privacy and technology lawyer, and I just have an article coming out in the International Association of Privacy Professionals publication called Privacy Tracker. And to answer this gentleman's question, it talks about how you navigate business and legal risks in the cloud. And I think what I'm hearing people talk around here, but you really need to look at those terms of service, look at your business. For example, I represent financial institutions. If I'm sitting down across from a cloud computing provider and I say, okay, look, these are some questions we need to have answered. I've got regulations on my back that I have to prove up that I've done my due diligence. Where is your data stored? Well, what do you mean? We have multiple server locations across the country and the world. We chase the cheapest power, as Chris said. Great, awesome. Are they in Eastern Europe? Well, some of the times they might be. Guess what, guys? No, my data won't be there. When I have Eastern European crime rings that are concentrating on stealing credit card information and debit card information from my customers. So I think people need to become very sophisticated about the questions they ask the cloud computing providers, and the providers themselves need to realize, hey, your one-size-fits-all contract is not going to work for certain businesses and industries. So this is gonna be a discussion, I think, that there are personal privacy implications that are very important, but the businesses are gonna be the ones that are doing the Facebook thing saying, we're not accepting this.
My only retort to that would be like, if I'm a financial services company, I probably already built the system myself. I'm not going to a cloud computing person.
I
think she's right. That's more detail on the point I want to say again. I know I keep saying this. You are the customer, right? You have the right to make demands. All of those businesses will customize services. I guarantee you, if I went to Salesforce.com and I said, I am spending that $2 million, there is a whole bevy of things they would do for me regarding privacy policy, regarding everything. So at the end of the day, it's the same thing I tell people with open source. Like, should I use proprietary or should I use open source? Right? I don't know which one is best for your business. What resources do you have? What implications are there with privacy and security and everything? Every one of these technology decisions, and that's why I have a problem with some of these standards and even some of the Amazon web services that they offer. They're like, well, you just need this. Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, it will do part of what I need to do, but it may not be everything, right? Hence why a couple months ago they made it where you could start adding whatever components out of everything they have and kind of build your own, right? That was actually a response to a number of customers who were very large customers, like big shoe manufacturer size, who didn't want to use just the standard stuff.
Back there, Claire.
Salesforce.com. Are you saying that there is a false sense of security? Because you have to file. I mean, it's okay that.
You may be in breach of your agreement. You may be in breach of very significant regulatory laws, depending on what area you're in. If you're a health information provider, If you're a financial provider,
yeah.
Okay, if you've got audit information, if you're a publicly traded company, and you have accounting information that's over there, yeah, because it may well not be auditable.
You have to be working from a specific terminal. You can't just work from any terminal. You have to be permission. You have to have permission to work from that terminal. So it gives the companies we're a charity.
Right.
You know, so it's giving us an idea of, wow, it has to be secure because look at how much you have to go through just to get in and have our own employees get into it. So you're saying it's false sense of security because anybody can hack into this?
Well, no.
And because it's a matter of law, it's in the hands of a third party.
But by the way, that illusion that they tell you about you have to be at a certain terminal, right? This key right here, this is part of that you have to be at a certain terminal. Now, on Salesforce.com and all of those others, works in any web browser that does the standard encryption. So even that, I mean, that's the problem is, I think she made a really valuable point, which is ask more questions, right? People assume that this is what it says on the website, this is the only offering I can get. People assume that changes can't be made. People assume that because they can sell it to me, even though they know I'm a nonprofit that does health information, they must have thought about the implications, which they haven't.
The federal government has used Salesforce.com for information. The Obama campaign has used and built a site based on...
There's two sites. The Obama campaign site had nothing to do with the federal government. It's a private site. The stuff that the federal government uses, and they do use it, right, for mainly procurement and other activities, those are all in a separate data center on separate servers at Salesforce.com, but just for them to fit their specific requirements.
So Salesforce has a specific thing just for them, and maybe
sure
they'll
do it
with them just for that.
I sit on the board of two companies that work with the federal government, and I will tell you right now, when working with them, the amount of crap you have to go through to sell to them is unbelievable. It took us a year just to get on the GSA schedule, okay, with a product that they were already using in several installations. All right, our product does security for national labs, all right, the one company I'm on the board of. And I'm going to tell you, it is like they send a list of requirements all the time. Well, we changed this. The FIPS encryption needs to be different, and now we need this certification and this and that. And there are situations where sometimes the products have literally just been taken out of service until that's done. I mean, don't let Salesforce or any other company that does governmental sales trick you into thinking that the government is buying the same thing that you're buying, because they're not, in most cases. In products that don't involve data and data security and stuff like that, sure, probably. But in most cases, don't let them fool you into thinking that they're buying the same thing they're selling you with your credit card, because they're not.
Just a point to what you're talking about. You're working with a vendor that has a particular process. They have a standardized product or service that they're offering, and you want to negotiate something a little bit different to get different terms for greater privacy or backup recovery protection or whatever. When you ask them to step outside of their normal package, you're usually asking for trouble because you'll have swapping of resources, and they may not know all of the processes, procedures in order to follow. So you wind up introducing additional problems by customizing standard products and service offerings. So you have to be really careful about asking for something different.
Again, all of these things come down to one simple rule: it comes to software and business. Do what's best for your business. Get the legal counsel, get the IT counsel, get the guy in the data center, right? Get everybody together and find out what all the requirements are, and then, you know, put out an RFP and make sure the vendors come to you. And by the way, just for the record, it's not, what was your name?
I'm Aaron.
Aaron?
Yeah.
That's Aaron's point on getting them to customize, which I agree with, but we got to give credit where credit's due.
Yeah. Let's do that.
Well, but besides that, their standard contract, it's an adhesion contract, okay? They hired a lawyer to give them all the rights and you none.
Let's also remember that as soon as you start doing all this customization of the contract, a lot of the price advantage starts evaporating.
Yes.
Right.
Instantly.
And so when this price advantage starts evaporating, you may actually start benefiting by just going back to to co-location and standard software licenses with perhaps contractors managing things, where all of a sudden a lot of the legal issues of privacy and waiving the privacy just disappear because you own everything now.
Now, unfortunately, you're taking more management cost, but you're there. You have to manage the process anyway when you went to this conversion. So there's reasons that this complexity may not disappear.
Salesforce doesn't seem to me to be like a cloud computing application.
Well, then you haven't read.
Marketing is great, isn't it?
Apparently, you are trying to do what we in the.
Let me finish my question before you answer. Hang on. Because when you look at their application, what they're doing is they're sharing it among a lot of people, right? But theoretically, they're not really sharing among a lot of people because everyone's customizing every one of their instances. The government has special instances. They all have special instances. My point is that it's under the control of Salesforce.
Absolutely.
Okay. So when I think about cloud computing, that's why I started off by saying maybe I'm a little confused as to what the subject is, but I think about the applications where they're out there in the cloud. Like, for instance, one of the questions I had is, how does Akamai, for example, to me that seems like they own all these servers, you put something out there, you distribute it all over the world. So the thing is that there's a variety of different types of information that goes out there. I absolutely, coming back from the time sharing days, selling time sharing off of a prime computer, right? The deal is that you had agreements at that time where it was between two companies and they were very well negotiated and it was very well detailed out. In this particular case, you're basically, clicking on radio buttons saying you accept. And what's even more scarier is when they do their upgrades, they send that back to you and ask you to accept it again.
Here's what's more scarier. You've got some IT guy who doesn't know anything about the law, and you said, yeah, sure, buy that software. And when he gets that, he doesn't even think about calling this guy. He just goes, click it. And your company is now on the line.
But
because in theory, usually, where you have a corporate officer and they have the ability to negotiate on that one, it's already been proven in several court cases that guy doing that and deploying that software, because he's in that bank, He just committed your company to whatever that says, privacy policy.
So I guess my question leading up to the question was to really try to understand as a business owner or as even an end user, consumer, a person who's clicking on all these things all the time, what protection do you really have other than to say, don't talk on the phone of a good, something you want to protect, don't talk on the phone and don't put it in the computer. Basically, that's the only way to keep it private.
Here's the protection.
And don't write it down.
Most people don't want your idea anymore.
Right.
All right. The horrible, horrible fact and situation is there are tons and tons of startups who, have the next great thing or whatever. And I get I started the InfoWorld blog 6 weeks ago. I get on average 300 and 400, 500 last week. We have the next great cloud computing company. Here's our business plan in your email inbox. By the way, don't share it with anybody, right? Okay. The fact is, with the exception of some crazy new, really radical change in how we do technology, when it comes to software, and this is why software patents, and I have 12 of them, okay? And I do a bunch of open source, but I have a problem with where the patent system has ended up because it's not new and novel for the most of it. What's your protection? Your protection is who doesn't want it? Because as we were discussing earlier, security has a purpose, right? And that purpose isn't to say nobody will ever get your stuff. That purpose is to make it as difficult as possible for them to do that, right? Because it's essentially, when you think about somebody going from server to server hacking it, right? Why do they always pick on Microsoft servers? Because it takes less time and resource. It's easier, right? They publish their patches and they go, well, they're fixing this. This must be what's wrong. There you go. Right, so what security do you have? Do background checks, hire good employees, don't tell people information they don't need to know. I would say Koch's formula, right? Kernel secret recipe are two great examples of what he said of trade secret that have still been protected for forever. And they don't have a patent on them, they don't have any security, right? The kernel secret recipe is like locked in like a little safe or something somewhere.
This is true.
So you're saying have discretion.
I'm just saying use common sense.
Yeah.
That's the best security going.
There's a question over here.
I do. I've heard at least two big picture different models of cloud computing discussed here. One is the software as a service model, something highly structured like Salesforce.com, where you have to fit your data into their structure. And the other is something more like Amazon Web Services, where they give you something almost blank and you use it as a tool, but it's still distributed around the world in that way. And I guess from a, I happen to be cursed with being a lawyer myself, and I'm trying to think about this from a legal perspective, how far back do you have to retreat? I mean, if you use blank slices on Amazon S3, or if you use a co-location center, is the main difference Aaron's point that you know where the location is? Is
no,
there really,
no.
What's the difference?
If you're in co-location, you actually have, what you created more or less in law is some kind of property interest in that site.
So how about
it's almost like a real property lease. You're putting your equipment in there.
I'll tell you
what equipment.
Actually have.
You haven't given it over to anybody.
Where it fits in this schematic, it may fit in the wrong end, which is I have a couple of slices from SliceHost, SliceHost the company. So they're blank slices. I control everything on that slice.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
Except the kernel. What else do I not control on?
You do not have administrative control over the host that VM image is running on.
Okay.
Therefore, you don't really own that computer. Whoever has administrative control over the virtual machine hypervisor actually owns that computer.
You're leasing to the point where you control time, the whole thing down to the electrical plug.
Right.
Basically,
right.
You're leasing time on a machine instead of leasing a machine. Right, because when
that's
you lease a machine,
time share.
Right.
You're a lawyer, right?
Think
of who they send the subpoena to.
Right.
Okay, get a co-location arrangement.
I'm gonna get a foil
it'd have to come to you.
Comment, okay.
In an arrangement
precisely.
Like this,
okay.
It goes to the provider.
This guy right here is dead on. If you own that server, the subpoena comes to you. If you don't, it goes to Amazon, and you may never even see it coming.
Right. Yeah.
Right, because the court can compel them to not let you know, as you said earlier.
Well, they can compel me not to tell anybody either.
Oh, I get the NSA.
No, but there's a difference when the legal action's coming at you.
I understand.
It's a question back.
As a matter of fact, if you own that computing resource and you can install software on it, some of the software licenses that you're using to install that software are probably broken by the architecture you described.
Yeah.
They're not allowed.
That's true.
Basic open source licenses.
No, I'm not talking about open source. I'm talking about a proprietary license that expects that you're running it on a computer. You're running it on a computer that you own and control.
Okay.
It's why Amazon's not offering Windows Server.
Well, they are now, actually.
They are now because of the Azure, right? And now Microsoft has a new cloud licensing model.
Right.
But he's exactly right.
Sounds like a good thing to be able to say. It's not my data.
This is a question for Scott.
Right?
I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to defer to your expertise and your opinion on this.
I understand your distinction regarding keeping the data in-house or co-locating it versus moving your data to a third party. In regards to when you get the subpoena, are you going to know if it's within? If you own it, you're going to know first. If it's with a third party, then they're going to get the subpoena. But isn't that the main distinction? If the federal or state government thinks you're doing something wrong, through due process, they're going to search and seize your data and your server, regardless of whether it's with you or a third party, right?
Well, not necessarily, because if they give you a subpoena about your information, you can oppose it. You can move to quash it. Now, if your information is in the hands of a third party, they send them a subpoena, they don't care. They'll just give it up. They don't have to give you notice. You don't have a right to contest the production.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Well, if you don't have control over your data, then why would you?
You want to look in there.
Right. Quick look is really scary because it's just like, we don't need it. We just want a brief look at it. Let's see.
How long is it brief?
Yeah.
Well,
how long is a brief, Scott?
Okay, so I don't mean to turn this into a legal discussion or
come on, there are lawyers in the room.
Just for full disclosure, who in the audience is an
attorney? I think it's a practical thing. Consider this information to be money. Okay, now are you going to just leave your money in some third party?
What if it's all your money? You going to let them? I mean, aren't you going to be worried about the circumstances under which this third party is holding your money? Or are you going to? Yes, very much. Information is money.
Very worried about what
It is property. And you just need to be concerned about who has custody and control of your property as a business, or even worse, if you're a business, information you have about your customers to whom you may well have a contractual or statutory duty of privacy and security. And by using cloud computing, it is possible, depending on the nature of your business and the nature of the information, that there are laws out there that affirmatively prohibit use of cloud computing.
Scott, we several times compared cloud computing to time sharing, and you talked about all the ramifications, these legal ramifications. Can you cite any case law from time sharing that would apply to cloud computing?
Yes, there are some relatively old criminal cases that basically did apply the third party doctrine, which I described as coming from U.S. versus Miller, to the time sharing context. They predate the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, but they're there.
So how would the law need to change in order to make things better for us?
Not very well.
Well, don't expect it to, okay? Because the people up there that are making laws don't understand this stuff. They don't understand the technologies. Yeah. You know, they think it's a system of pipes.
Yeah, remember the
internet
is a pipe or a
trough. I think the point here is that please don't take away the notion that I'm arguing against using cloud computing. Okay? You just need to be aware of the risks, and you need to read the contract, and you need to think through the consequences of what you're doing. And until the law does catch up with the technology, which, by the way, will never happen.
Right.
Then you need to be very aware of what your terms of service say and be aware of the extent to which you may still not be protected no matter what they say. And then you make your business decision.
And Scott, tell me if you agree. It comes down to common sense in running a business. I just talked to a group of startups before driving over here for this. And, you know, the question was like, oh, how they're picking their stuff, right? And I went through and I helped them show how they could save money, do this and do that. It didn't even involve open source, right? It involved doing something other than going, well, Jimmy uses Salesforce, so we should use that. There's a plan that fits in our budget. Click, right? And people just don't do enough research. They don't do enough demands. Companies will make massive changes if enough of you want them made, period. And the great thing now is you don't have to be in proximity to have a crowd of people to talk about that, right? You've got the internet.
Call it crowd computing.
Right. I mean, what? Actually, I did, because you joke, but you know, the future is not about the cloud. It is about the crowd, right? It's about consumers starting to say, wait a second, those laws aren't right, and this isn't. What about the Google Chrome thing that you mentioned, right? Do you think Google would have ever brought that up to CNET or anybody? Been like, hey, by the way, did you read this?
The Facebook, right? the recent Facebook
policy change.
Right, this is the second time they've tried to slip something.
And by the way, right. Who gets it changed? It's when somebody sees it and tells everybody, and you guys, as consumers of those products, say, whoa, whoa, whoa. And when you do it in enough mass, what happens? Right? It changes. And it's the same thing with all of these privacy policies, all of this stuff, right? But, you know, companies, too often, people like you look at those companies and don't think, well...
But you're not changing the laws, you're changing the company policies.
But you can over a long, long time with a lot of lobbyists, because I had to do it myself.
It's also these click-through contracts that aren't real contracts, because we don't negotiate them, we have this habit.
They are legal.
I meant it in the pragmatic sense of how a human does a contract. You negotiate something. There's no negotiation here. It's a take it or leave it thing.
Right.
And so we're not used to the idea that we can actually negotiate with one of these vendors, particularly when there's very little or no money involved, right? So we give up stuff for this very vague thing, like, oh, sync my passwords, give them away. Google Docs, right?
Right.
I have a question.
But just don't read it and go, oh, or don't not read it and don't read it and then go, oh, but this doesn't matter. Because it does matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many of you have ever read a terms of service on like Google or Yahoo or something when you click through it?
I
Caroline, I know you did.
I didn't read those, but I read
Caroline,
my.
Caroline, everybody I know, I am for sure 100% that you did.
I read my Blizzard one for World of Warcraft. I read that.
Right. I think we have 1 year and 1 year.
I have money on
that as well.
A question on the Click Crowd. And then you have the terms of services. How much are you bound to the terms of services when you watch a website? Because this is very vague.
This is not a legal opinion, but ClipWrap is considered an actual assent, in other words, an agreement. A lot of people will post in common law that if you use the site, that is also an assent to the terms. Okay? And some of those have stood the test of court.
It depends on the particular issue.
I had a friend
who got sued and lost because of terms of service are clearly marked. And in fact, the website, and they made terms of service really big, and they proved in court that it says terms of service right there. He could have easily as clicked on that as he did click to enter the site.
What if he's not running Flash Player?
Huh?
Or if he hadn't been running Flash Player?
He probably would have been safe. You know what I'm saying?
I think as a general proposition, the court would try to find that there was a contract. They may be more willing in some areas to try to avoid specific terms. Things such as class action waivers, waiver of right to jury trial, mandatory commercial arbitration on the moon. things such as that. A court may well be willing to void certain terms, but typically speaking, they're going to try to find a contract. I mean,
some of them don't even make sense. Like some of the term services that I read were well, if you can access the website and the information that's in there only for personal and non-commercial use.
Well, actually, it's not that they don't make sense. It's that they don't make sense to you. Because this guy over here, as he said it earlier, he just threw that shit together for you anyway. But I guarantee you, he knows every single thing that it means. But when you look at that, that's actually funny you mention that, because that's exactly his problem. He took some of the information from the website, and he repurposed it, and he used it in a presentation. And the guy that had the website was in the audience and was like, you took that information from my website.
Right.
Now, he didn't include a screenshot. He didn't include, literally, it was a conceptual argument. And he said, it says right there in the terms of service, for personal and non-commercial use, he was getting $2,500 to speak, commercial use, right? Is what the court said, right or wrong. Right. And at the end of the day, by the way, I've testified in a bunch of federal court cases, and what he said is what you should listen to, because they don't, trying to talk about the technology is pointless. is absolutely pointless.
Okay, one more question.
So this, it almost sounds like this topic should be why cloud computing sucks. there got to be some.
Exactly.
We had a pre-call to discuss this. We all agreed we're not trying to say don't do it. Right. Just understand the limits and the risks and understand your business. Because we're all speaking in generalizations. We don't know what your business is.
Precisely.
Okay?
So can we just spend a little bit of time about what some of the positives are? I mean, the promoted positives are like lower total cost of ownership.
But that's not true.
Sometimes.
Just put on the internet tomorrow. Okay. Get all the positives. So see, here's the deal. If I would have made that call, and if I would have been, it'd been like cloud computing does not exist, right? Much of this, the dismay of the Info World editors, my first blog, which they softened the title of, was pretty much, the hell are you talking about? Cloud computing is a marketing term from Salesforce.com and a bunch of other companies, now Amazon. It is a data center, like any other data center, right? It is a different way for you to purchase your part of that data center, which changes the legal implications. It changes the technical implications about what you can manage.
But for the kind of small business who doesn't have a data center,
with
a data center, they get cloud computing. If without one, they don't have one.
No.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily so. And the thing is all you're doing is you're buying compute resources from someone who's marketing them to you in a different fashion. You're still buying the same resources. There's some processing power, there's some memory, there's some bandwidth, whatever. And the initial barrier to entry absolutely is cheaper. You're right, and that's a big positive. However, you have to weigh that in contrast to, does it scale financially for me? Which in a lot of cases it doesn't. And more importantly, what happens from a legal implication? Because if you look at your Fourth Amendment rights, as you stated several times tonight, if you start a business and you take other people's information, you can't really do a contract. I mean, can you even do a contract with them and protect their privacy when you don't have, you know, the legal right to, you know?
You can be compelled by the courts to disclose it. And at best, whoever's information that supposedly is, can sue me. And I'm going to have a perfect defense for it. I was compelled to disclose.
Right, exactly.
But to clarify your point, you can be a small business, you don't have a data center, but I can go to a hosting company and get a server that's dedicated to me, and that now I...
And cheap, too.
And cheap, too, by the way. And run my applications on that, and there's more protection in that.
So from the small business perspective, if you are willing to make your business match what the standardized offering is so that you can capture the maximal cost savings by minimal changes to the services you're buying, then the cloud standardized offerings are probably really good because you are trying to totally capture the commoditized aspect of these services. All right. But if you're not willing to do that, then you're entering the world of customized services.
I disagree. You're characterizing cloud computing as Google and Salesforce as the behemoth cloud computing service provider. None of you have mentioned small and medium businesses providing cloud computing with individualized contracts. Wait, hang on. So there are small and medium businesses that are using colocation data centers that are offering cloud computing services to small and medium businesses with privacy contracts that are not cookie cutter.
That they can't enforce. That's right. The point. If I start a startup, and I actually, I may have somebody who wants to call you, because I'm sitting on the board of a company that this just happened to 3 weeks ago. They started the company, they used a service that said, we can guarantee the privacy, we can guarantee all of this. They're doing basically wealth management, okay, system, all right? So they've got all this data, and they're like, we can't buy your service unless we know this. They did what you said, they negotiated, they made them a promise. Well, guess what? One of those guys, what's the Barry, what's his face? Who's the guy that robbed all the $50
billion? Yeah, Madoff.
So that guy, one of the guys invested in that guy. Well, guess how he found out about that? The company found out when the customer called and said, I just found out that 4 weeks ago, you gave up all of my information in this court case. And you know what the provider said? We were compelled to do it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what my company can say? Jack. They've just broken that privacy contract. They've broken the contract with the customer and everything, and they have no protection. They're completely exposed. And it's not to say that those companies aren't. I think it's great that there's small to medium people doing that. But the rules, whether it's big or small, Salesforce or five guys in Austin in West Austin, the rules don't change from a technology perspective or from a legal perspective. Still the same.
So again, let me get back to my point. He's absolutely correct about the legal implication. But cloud computing makes sense when you are willing to match your business to the standardized offering.
Right.
If you take yourself out of the standardized offering, you're now into the whole economics of customized computing. And then you have the risks of all of these legal issues and the costs of management of that customized computing, whether it's a big vendor or a small vendor that you're buying from.
And I'm gonna be really, really blunt. Back in 89, when I started doing this, managing a server was like black magic, okay? It was like, don't mess with the web guy, right? In 93, I worked at Apple Computer, and there was a guy who won't say his name, but you know who I'm talking about. He could probably murder someone in his cube, and they'd be like, just look, can we get that cleaned up tomorrow morning? Whatever we do, do not let the crazy mystical guy press the wrong key on the keyboard and have the internet go away, okay? But the simple fact is it's like, now, you know, what's the problem with system management? You know, my company faces, you know, this challenge from open source and everything everybody says. Not really. What we face a challenge is it's getting easier and easier and easier to do this. My 12-year-old, who, by the way, love him to death, is not like some crazy rocket science kid, put 5 PlayStations together in an array because he read it in Wired. And he found the monitoring software and put it on there himself. All right, it's like your small business can run a web server, trust me.
Yeah.
Right? Or there's people who will do it.
I'll be more than happy.
Or he'll be happy to do it for you. Really cheap.
That's where it goes.
He's expensive.
We're pretty much out of time.
All right. Let me give you a quick example that we've buy versus cloud that we just went through with a small business that's starting up. They came to us about 9 to 10 months ago, and they had 8 employees at the time, and they were going to outsource their stuff to essentially a cloud company, software as a service, to manage their manufacturing in Texas, California, and Taiwan. And so they needed to have internet connectivity to all this stuff. So we went through and we started talking to them about what they needed, back and forth, and what their growth plans were and everything like that. And we ran some real simple numbers and figured out that when they got to be 25 people accessing the software as a service, they were going to be paying more money per month than they would on going to Dell and leasing a server and putting that server in our data center and managing it themselves. So they decided finally to just go ahead and do the lease thing for 3 years. Put the server in our data center. They get to run their own cloud, if you will. But they also get all the privacy advantages because they own the server. We don't know the admin password on the box. And if anybody comes to us with a subpoena and says, hey, we want that server, we'll say, sorry, no can do. It belongs to these guys over here. Go bug them with your paperwork. So that's, those are the kinds of decisions that you have to make. And you do have to keep in mind, if you're a small business and you're outsourcing this stuff, there either are or soon will be license and use fees associated with this. So you've got to think about how those scale and how it's going to grow. And don't take your crazy wild-eyed growth number you show to your investors and friends and other people. Take your realistic one, and think, okay, well, if we triple in size in 5 years, we'll have 15 users. And can I afford that?
So spending with timeshare our lease on this space is up. It's after 9.
Yeah.
I like to thank everybody for coming here. This was sounds like we need to have part dough.
Yeah.
Full on.
Yeah, we can do another. Other thing is our website is effaustin.org, no hyphen. Please check it out. We're about to actually change. We're going to change the website pretty quickly. And EFF Austin will have more of these events in the coming months. And our email list, there's a link at effaustin.org to our mailman listserv, so you can sign up for our discuss list, there we are.
Hey.
Oh, yeah, come to our party at South by Southwest. We have a huge party. We do it every year. It's been getting bigger and bigger. It's been growing like the Blob, if you ever saw that movie. And this year we're doing it at the Palmer Events Center, and it's kind of a massive thing. EFF Austin originally started throwing this party for National EFF. We're actually separate organizations, which we can explain sometime. But the party is March 16th, Palmer Events Center, 6 p.m. Please join us. Please go to the site, sign up, come to more of these meetings, let everybody know about the meetings, get the word out, and we'll have our revival that I mentioned earlier. Thanks. Thanks for coming.